I hear you, brother.
I can hear you though.
All right, all right. We here, we here, we here. Yeah. Definitely want to welcome everyone to a very, very live special recording of Technical Talks. I am your host, Dre James, with a very special crew here today. We're going to start here from left to right with my esteemed business partner, Rublin Chu.
Hi, everyone. Good morning. Thank you guys for joining in. I'm Rublin Chu, co-founder of Access 2. I have a background in business as well as hardware engineering. I'm very passionate about community outreach. Mr. Lehman.
What's up? My name is Logic Man. I'm an educator for the last 22 years, currently living in Seattle, Washington, but I work in Tacoma, Washington at Lincoln High School as an assistant principal. I'm a jack of many trades, you know, educator, you know what I'm saying, community activist, performing artist. I do stand up, also producer and hip hop artist. So I also started something called the Griot Party Experience, which is spoken word storytelling theater, which creates safe places for us to tell our story so we can heal from our collective unique trauma.
Absolutely. Dr. Davis.
Dr. Keenan Davis, glad to be here. Share the stage with everybody. The founder of One Institution Media, a new startup, a media production company, distribution, podcast shows, one of the first of its kind. I think of us as the Netflix of podcasts. I'm excited to give people a voice, no matter how big or small a story, to demonstrate their passion, their purpose, and hopefully be a part of the solutions to the many problems that society provides or gives to all of us.
Absolutely. Myself, Dre James, co-founder of Access 2, where we curate culture, and really at the end of the day, just try to get people working. With that being said, I want to introduce our audience to what would I say, a legend, hands down. I would go into a personal spiel about him myself, but to me, this brother has been doing an extremely, I'd say above amazing job of finding his own voice and really, in his own words, serving that pure, raw, uncut Bolivian yayo, as he would say. I would like the world to go ahead and listen to this brother, Ari Spears, introduce himself on this stage.
I cannot top what you just said, so I'm gonna go with what you just said. What up, what up? Ari Spears in the building. Thank y'all for having me, man.
Appreciate you, appreciate you. Now, normally I would start this show off a certain way, but I kind of want to explain why we're here for Technical Talks, because really it's technically just talking. Where we combine, you know, influencers with education. And right now, when we're talking about podcasting and getting in front of this microphone, I'm very adamant about, you know, letting people know and understand that when you choose to do so, you're educating. So today I want to start out with a quote from one of the GOATs by the name of Paul Mooney. That quote states, "I've never seen anyone more messed up over success than Richard Pryor. For him, it's a constant battle between success in the white world and keeping it real for his black self." Tell me, Mr. Spears, how has it been, you know, over the last 30 years, you know, finding the success in your voice while trying to stay and maintain that true authenticity to yourself?
Well, I mean, you know, that's its own craft to master. And I don't know that I do that well. I'm not going to be the one to say that I'm, you know, when people use titles like GOAT, legend, icon, I take it if you want to give it. But I would never brand myself any of those things, because you just said it. I think the real GOAT, the real legend is Richard Pryor, Eddie Murphy, Dave Chappelle, guys whose body of work speaks for itself. Maybe in terms of my longevity, because I've been doing this for 31 years. If you want to give me credit for that, I'll say I deserve that. But anything else to me is just too subjective. But to answer your question, I know what I'm doing in terms of funny. I know I'm good at funny, but being good at funny is very different from being good at this business. One sometimes feels like it has nothing to do with the other. And I would think, like most people, the two are intertwined. But, you know, there's a master to there's an art level to mastering how to finagle through this landmine field, which is called show business. So I'm trying to figure that part out because I haven't figured it out and I haven't done it well, which is why I'm where I'm at.
You could have fooled us. You could have fooled us. So starting at the beginning, you know, your first show was at the Uptown Comedy Club in Harlem.
Yeah.
You know, I heard you tell a story about your mom putting you on the train and hitting uptown, going to the improv.
Yeah.
My question to you is tell me about the first time you saw Eddie Murphy and what was that thing that inspired you about him that made you want to pick up the microphone?
Well, you know, I was born in 75, so I grew up in the 80s. I was an 80s baby. And by the time he got on SNL, obviously prior to him, since the show's inception, when it first started and they were called the Not Ready for Primetime Players, a la Gilda Radner, Chevy Chase, Dan Aykroyd, Belushi, Garrett Morris. That's when the show really, from immediately jump, came into its own, but that was before me. So my era was Eddie, and just watching Eddie Murphy every week on SNL with me and my dad, that was kind of like our bonding thing. And you know, when Eddie was on the show, the only other person worth mentioning was Joe Piscopo. But still, Eddie was the guy. So watching him with my dad and watching him do James Brown, Celebrity Hot Tub, and Richard Simmons, and Mr. Rogers, and all his takes on things and all his impressions was really something I just gravitated towards. And, you know, I always had the ability for mimicry as a child. So I kind of felt like between being amazed that he could do it and I was trying to do it. Then later on, as I grew up and I read stories on him and found out we had the same birthday. He started when he was 14. He's from New York. I just kind of took all that as motivation to want to pursue this thing.
Absolutely.
So, question I wanted to ask you, Aries, is like, how do we draw the line? You know, because I do stand up also, you know what I'm saying? And I injected in my teachings and as being an educator and whatnot. And so how do we draw the line between comedy and being serious? Because it's very interesting because Black people are very unique because we use humor to, you know, heal ourselves, you know, from our trauma. And a lot of people don't understand Black cultural humor. Be like, man, why y'all laughing about stuff like that? Stuff like that ain't really funny. And when we get really serious about it, be like, yeah, maybe it ain't so funny. You know what I'm saying? That my mom used to beat me or something like that. That's child abuse, or that's not necessarily funny about other things. Like, you know, we'll joke about everything. Police brutality. I mean, you know what I'm saying? Richard Pryor had jokes about, you know, put the camera down and come help. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, how do we draw that line between being humorous and being serious and bring it together, you know, to create some kind of, you know what I'm saying, you know, some kind of activation in our community to build community and make change?
Well, I think as far as comics talking about truth and pain, I don't know that that's necessarily just relegated to Black people because truth is pain. And I think all comedians of all colors talk about what's been painful to them. I think the difference is we talk about race, and race is our pain. It's our history. And I've heard white comics, I won't say no names, but one of whom I respect and one of whom is highly regarded as one of the best in the game, try to say that Black comics talking about Black white issues is hacky. Like, we all Black people this, white people that. But it's arrogant to say that, and it's dismissive because that's not your reality. That's not your pain. We live that pain. We live that reality. This skin color is a 24/7 pajama to the day we die. We don't get out of this. So I often think that when it comes to race and toeing the line comedically, while there are white people who certainly understand it, who are willing to embrace it, a Richard Pryor, an Eddie Griffin, a Dave Chappelle, a Chris Rock, myself, who all talk about race, there are also those who are arrogant and dismissive and naive about it and look at it as like a happy thing to do. And I never understood where that came from, because it's like, again, this is our reality 24/7. We wake up with this. We go to bed with this. We live with this. And some of us die because of this. So I just say, do what you do naturally. I wish I could be, and this is no slam to Kevin Hart, because I've always said that Kevin is phenomenal. And certainly his box office receipts show you how phenomenal he is. But you know, I wish I could be ba 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 ba. He's McDonald's. He's Madison Avenue. I'm more MOP, Annie Up. You know, I'm more DMX. Where my dog's at, Rough Riders. You know what I mean? And that comes with a price. That comes with consequences. I think, you know, and I think it was Kevin that quoted this. He said, I'm not trying to be the best comedian. I want to be the biggest comedian. Is he the biggest comedian? Yes. Is he the best comedian? Now, while this is subjective, I would say Dave Chappelle is the best comedian. The late, great Patrice O'Neill is the best comedian. When you look at their content, what they talked about, how they pushed the envelope, how they were risk takers, fearless, and made you talked about things that were true and uncomfortable. You put that in the mix with their likability and their ability to be versatile, gather audiences of all colors. That's a hell of a gumbo recipe. But Kevin's the biggest, and you know, in Hollywood and in life, likability, I think, goes a long way. Not to say you can't be likable and controversial, because you can. I'm that. Chappelle's that. Patrice was that. Chris Rock is that. Eddie Griffin is that. But I don't think it's a coincidence that the rewards and the treasures at the end of that rainbow aren't the same as when you are completely bop, 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 bop. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So going off of that, Mr. Spears here. So there are days I know for a fact that are difficult to keep moving forward and pushing, you know, when the weight are on our shoulders, especially with things that are happening in society right now. Like, how do you keep yourself disciplined and focused to what you're actually doing, your craft, and what motivates you and gets you going every day? Because motivation is not going to be there every day.
Yeah, I mean, it's not an easy thing. Because you're trying to navigate more than one thing at once. And ideally you would love for them to be equally successful. But again, walking down this path, it's not really realistic. So you have to ask yourself what's important to you. I'm trying to become more of a businessman in the show business aspect. And, you know, a great quote that I read from Warren Buffett: if you can't control your emotions, you can't control your money. Now, I've never been one to go, I'm fully motivated by money. No, I'm fully motivated by being great. If you're great, the money will be there. But at the same time, the older I get, the more my expectations change. You know, at one point in my 20s, I wanted the money. I wanted the fame. I wanted it all. Now, the older I get, I'm like, damn, just give me the money, man. Because fame is fleeting and it's false. I'll take the fame too. But as I get older, I realize what's more important to me. So I say that to say, when I'm on Instagram and motherfuckers talk shit and want to call me washed up and get them, like, you know, hit my nerves, I'm quick to try to match wits with you and battle you. Because if you want to play tongue tennis with me and play mental chess, I'm going to show you, I'm going to beat you. But that comes with a price. If I can't control my emotions and I keep going at motherfuckers the way I go at people, well, then guess what? Now my Instagram is suspended, which is an avenue to make money, which is an avenue to use my platforms to grow into other things. So I got to learn to control my emotions so I can control my money.
Going off that, because as a community, we tend to push our children out at 18. When I hear you talk, I hear the most important part is as I got older. And you said it a few times, as I got older. Describe how important it was, you know, for, and before I say that, you know, I want to say that I'm working diligently right now to try to change that, you know, that stigma that we should force our kids out at 18, tell them to go find a job and make it. You, I would say, are an exception to the rule, going from New York to the other side of the country and settling down in LA, and also finding, you know, learning to, you know, to understand what fame is and how real or how fake it was. Explain to us how important it was to have a plan, you know, how important it was to actually take that plan and utilize it and develop that plan throughout your career.
I mean, it's always nice to have a plan, but at the end of the day, if we're being honest, part of your plan is just going off the sheer guts and belief, you know, because Keenan Ivory Wayans once said, and I had always believed this, and I didn't need to hear him say it to believe it or already know it. To me, there's no such thing as a plan B, because a plan B means you prepare for failure. So if you only got a plan A, which is success and success only, well, then that's what it's going to be. But part of that is guts and faith and just going, fuck it. So that's what it was for me. Yeah.
Absolutely.
I think the one thing I wish my parents did a better job of, but they didn't know it. And the generations before them didn't know it. It's a generational thing. I wish Black people would, as a community, we would do a better job of making our children financially literate. It's okay to push them out at 18, but equip them with the knowledge financially they need to succeed from 18 on. If you're going to go, yo, I'm going to kick you out the house, get out, but I'm not going to give you nothing for survival. I'm going to just send you out to war with nothing. Well, damn. But at least if you can teach your kids to be financially literate, you've already given them a weapon. And my parents weren't financially literate because, like I said, generational. Before them, they weren't, and they weren't, and they weren't. And I'm the most successful money guy in my family. But I'm going off of not knowing. I'm learning as I go, as opposed to somebody preparing me, which means I've made a lot of fucking mistakes.
Logic and Dr. Davis have both dedicated their lives to service, starting with building a network and building your own network. What I had to learn with my own kids, I've said this before, is, you know, they don't learn 1 to 100 anymore. They don't learn A to Z. They learn through networks. They're almost born with a cell phone in their hand. By the time they're 5 or 6 years old, they're wanting a tablet. Technology is constantly evolving. I want to ask all three of you.
Well, before you go there, it's okay to want the iPad and the iPhone, yep. But what's more important is what you do with it. If you're going to use the iPad and the iPhone to just look at Instagram videos and TikTok all day, well, then that's a waste of time. Matter of fact, the technology is either the blessing or it's the curse. And too many times we use it as the curse instead of the blessing. You know, I don't follow a bunch of model, I don't know if you call them memes or whatever you call them. I don't follow a bunch of model shit, the girls in bikinis twerking their ass. I don't follow a lot of entertainment shit. I follow all money things. Mm-hmm. Bitcoin, crypto, Bill Gates, Grant Cardone. So I'm trying to get financially literate more so that I can see ass at a strip club. So I, you know what I'm saying? So it just depends on what you do with it.
Absolutely. So with that being said, a quote from Patrice O'Neill is, just making the crowd laugh is not really doing anything for me anymore. That's just knowing how to kill. I've learned how to kill, but also learning what laughter is meaningful. I think that's what you're kind of touching on is getting into the meaning of business and in your craft and honing it into something that can teach. Dr. Davis, I want to talk to you about one institution and where that began for you as far as creating a network and getting in front of a microphone and creating the ability to teach for yourself, because a lot of that is parallel to a stand-up comedian. You get one mic, you get one stage. When you're a teacher, you get one classroom, you get many stages, you get many hecklers. Describe to me the journey, you know, from, you know, beginning with an idea all the way into the fruition of one institution. Logic, I would like you to kind of go into the Griot Party once Dr. Davis is done and kind of explain the thought processes behind that. And then we'll finish up with Mr. Spears really doing the same thing, explaining to us about how to control your network, how to build your network business-wise and understanding what to do with it.
But before he does that, let me just point out, but very rarely do teachers get pussy after a lesson. These jokes get you laid. These jokes get you laid, nigga.
Oh my God.
I guess that's why I'm a stand-up comedian too.
How do you guys keep your meaningful relationships in business?
You know, that's interesting. You know, how are you funny, man? For real. You said a few things, you know, in your explanation of kind of like how you came up, you know what I mean, and your parents and their parents and the financial literacy with our people. And so what I've learned as a dude from the mud, got it off the curve, not no rap hood, but the real hood, where ain't nobody got a pot to piss in and a window to throw it out, like that kind of hood. Did none of us know anything? And by and large, is the reason why none of us were able to truly escape. And if we physically escaped, we weren't able to mentally escape, right? So we may have gotten a nice 9-to-5. We may have gotten a quality education from a institute of higher education, higher knowledge. And for whatever reason, because we lacked that financial literacy, because we lacked the social capital, the aggregate of relationships and people, associations you belong to, because we lack, you know, cultural capital, we've never been anywhere, never stamped a passport, because those type of things weren't introduced and thereby not deemed important. You know, when you get into life and you start creating infrastructure, you start trying to build a business, you try to maintain a certain level of wealth, right? I think Nas said something one day, he's like, you know, I'm too hood to be in the same circles I come from, but I'm not rich and wealthy enough to be in the circles I want to be in.
And one of my favorite lines from his songs.
And that's one of my lines in life. Like, it's not that I don't want to escape the people that I come from, but at the end of the day, you know, a lot of times, and I think everybody on this telecast can, you know, everybody can't go with you. And that's something, you know, you learn along the way, especially, you know, they see you, Ari, I think from a business perspective, and I'm not comparing it, but like I said, I come from a place where, you know, here I am, I'm in the news, I'm, you know, newspapers throughout life, all that type of stuff. And people assume that I got everything just because I got a credit, just because I'm in, you know, my name appears somewhere, like I got enough resources to carry a village. Like they don't understand, like, intergenerational, you know, to escape, to raise a family, like if you got your moms and you got like your grandma, or big mama, whomever, and you trying to get out of poverty, you got enough bread to get you out. But then if you use that little bitty bread you got to get the next person out, all of a sudden you done divided it in half. Now you got a third, and all of a sudden you really right where everybody else is. So the come up that you had acquired and accomplished really ain't a come up if you got to share it and give it away to somebody to help them get out of their situation. So I've learned in building stuff. I've been a part of 6 startups where I've either been the principal and primary investor, or in some capacity leading the initiative from idea to
at least idea to launch or launch to scale. You know, Dre, Ari, Rublin, Logic, I figured out that you got to be patient and you got to be persistent and you can't give a damn about what nobody else says or believe. Like whatever it is inside of you, whatever that little thing is that says, you know what, I'm funny. You know, that says, you know what, I can lead children. I can get people jobs. I can connect people. That's for you. You know, I said this last week to somebody, like before you share your vision with somebody else, make sure you really believe in it because they will talk you out of your dream. They will tell you everything that'll go wrong. Why a media company won't work. Why a joke won't make somebody laugh. Why a lesson plan won't hit home. Why? And I've listened to the crowd at times, and the crowd of they talked me out of what was for me. And as you realize, like over time, you know what I'm saying? Whatever is for you, you're gonna have to fight tooth and nails. You're gonna have to claw and scratch and mess up along the way. I know Ari, you mentioned, you know, tricked off some money. Shit. Me and you could have a sidebar conversation and we'll see who done tricked off the most. Because I didn't know what I was doing. You know, I got my first lick when I was 30, a lick for me, you know, multiply my salary times five. I was an NFL exec and I got opportunity to lead a startup. They gave me five times the salary I was making at the NFL. Shit, I'm 30 years old. Bought my mama a crib and did some other things, got some stuff together. Next thing you know, I'm right back at square one. The lick gone. I did some nice stuff, but it's still right back at square one. Now I'm 35 on food stamps, straight up for 6 months. And it's just like, you go through those ebbs and flows enough in life and you realize that you have to be patient and you have to be persistent, have to be relentless in the pursuit of your personal happiness. My happiness, I got a beautiful wife and two beautiful children. And my happiness is not necessarily embedded in the outcome of their own happiness. There is a collective happiness and there's an individual pursuit of my happiness. And I found out if I ain't right inside, I can't be right for nobody else. So I gotta be selfish in my own pursuit of my own version of happiness. And once I learned that I got self-love, self-reflection, self, everything starts with you. And that's where I think, you know, Dre, coming with this one institution media company, I looked around, you know, we talk about black on this. Listen, man, a dollar in a black neighborhood circulate less than 6 hours. Everybody else, whether it be, you know, Asian, white, Hispanic, everybody else circulating for days, sometimes weeks. We don't keep a dollar at all. And my mindset with this social equity of space of curating conversations, right? You had everybody else, whether it's Viacom, CBS, Walt Disney, you know, Fox, all of these spaces of technology when it comes to media and entertainment, hell, Hollywood, none of that shit is black. And we participate, we're leasing it, but we don't own any of it. So I wanted to create a platform with whomever that was willing to join me on that journey, that gave people, regular people, everyday people, a chance to amplify their voice, to tell their story, no matter how big or how small, to an audience to hopefully provide the solutions to life's most pressing problems. Because no disrespect, when I hear Kevin Hart, or if I hear Will Smith, or if I hear, you know, Jay-Z or Oprah, and they're sitting there telling me, this is how you solve this problem. Listen, man, I've looked at Oprah's 8 houses online. She owned 94 acres in Malibu. Straight up, she owned an island, all of Mercer Island in Washington coast. Like, she owned a bunker in the mountains in Colorado. Her problems and my problems, they different. And so yeah. I want to hear regular people talk about raising kids. I want to hear the dude at the barbershop talking about, you know, how she turned, you know, $10,000 into 50 bands. I want to hear that small business person that literally came up the hard way explain how they did it how they survived a marriage, how they, you know, got through infidelity, how they did whatever it is. I want to give their voice an opportunity, because to me, the regular people need regular people to talk to and to interact with. And that's what One Institution Media really is all about, is giving people the platform to be giving average everyday people a microphone.
And that's very simply put, the concept behind Technical Talks. I love that. That's amazing. Because Mr. Spears, I want you to know that even if you get up here and never say a word, you're still education. You're still teaching, because your life from a Black perspective, a business perspective, a spiritual perspective, a funny one, is all education to the next one coming behind you. Logic, also a stand-up comedian. You know, he's been there. You know, he's done the, you know, the jitters, you know, standing up on stage, trying to, you know, win over a crowd. He's also been an assistant principal at a high school for a decade. He understands what it is to get up in front of a crowd and try to teach. I want you two to have a conversation about that. What it is to be a teacher, because at the end of the day, when you're talking about talent, Paul Mooney said, Robin Williams learned techniques. He learned the technique of being funny. Describe that amongst yourselves. What is the technique of being funny? What is this? And then also having the ability to teach, because there's a technique within that. You've done that for 30 years. You've honed the ability to be absolutely funny. But at the end of the day, there's a little bit of truth behind almost everything you say when you get up there on that stage. Describe that for us.
Yeah, I don't necessarily know that. And you know, from my perspective, there's so much of a technique to it. I think you're born with certain instincts and you're born with certain gifts. And I think, you know, Barack Obama's ability to be a great orator is his gift. You know, not everybody has that, a la George Bush. you know, being a great speaker, being an intellectual, that's just something you either have or you don't. Everybody would love to be as intellectual as Dave Chappelle. Everybody would love to be able to mix great, funny humor with intellectual truth. It's not an easy thing to do. That's why everybody can't do it. So it's something you're simply born with. For me, I think the technical things that you learn are the things like, you know, when you're in a club, and this is why I can't stand when comedy club owners, and I think they take advantage of up and coming naive comedians, when they go, hey, I got a comedy class to teach you comedy. First of all, you can't teach this. You're born with it. Either something you got the ability to do or you don't. and you know, just because you own the team doesn't mean you can play the game. You know, because you own the comedy club or you manage the comedy club doesn't mean you know the first fucking thing about comedy. There's certain things that you only learn through experience, actual experience, going on the road, seeing the difference between a Southern crowd and an East Coast crowd, a West Coast crowd and a Midwestern crowd. You know, a club manager can't tell you how to deal with a heckler because he's never dealt with a heckler. A club manager can't tell you when you're setting up your joke. Now, this might be the technical things, but when you're setting up a joke, it's just as important for the audience to hear your setup as it is your punchline. Because if they don't hear your setup, your punchline will fall flat. So when you're setting up your setup, if someone is laughing too loud or they're not in sync with the rest of the crowd, they may step on a key word during your setup, which helps your punchline. So if you recognize that, you gotta go, take a beat, let them get that noise out the way, now continue, so that they hear it, so that the punchline works. Those are the technical things. Mm-hmm.
Ari, can I ask you something when you just mentioned that setup and punchline?
Yeah.
Because you just reminded me of something when you said that. Fun fact, Dre, you don't know this. I like battle rap, right? Like real battle rap. And there is a really, have you noticed the integration between comedy in battle rap in terms of how is so much effort put on the setup, but the punchline. Have you, being East Coast, and I know you like hip hop, have you noticed that? Have you seen?
Yeah, there's certain parallels to that. You know, I always say, like, even when I'm on stage and I do crowd work, if there's a moment that happens in the crowd where I got to destroy somebody, and before I do that, I was already in the middle of a joke, but then something happened, so I had to leave my bit to deal with the with that situation, and then I annihilate it. Your ego makes you go, now go back to your joke. You can't. You've missed the bust. That timing, that rhythm. So once you have to leave your bit, no matter how great it is, and it could be an award-winning bit, if you got to deal with chaos, once you're done with the chaos, you got to leave the bit alone. You got to not let your ego make you go, I got to do this bit because I wrote it and I know how good it is. No, the audience has missed the bus. That energy that you put into that situation, that chaos, they amped off that. Now you're trying to go back to a bit? Nah, the energy ain't the same. So you got to figure out a way to smoothly go transition from chaos back into the rhythm of what you was doing before that. So in terms of technique, that's what you could learn. But you only learn that through experience. A club manager can't teach you that. How can he teach you that if he's never done it?
Yeah. Let me tell you, he's a shark too. Because I told him, I went to a show in Seattle and I watched this man before the show even started walk around the crowd like a shark and just got you. And went up on stage. This man had me in the back corner checking my fly. Let me make sure my fly is up. I ain't got no boogers.
You know, it's funny. You know, to me, it's like, you know, people will come up to me and be like, yo, man, I'm surprised, yo, you don't be in the green room to the show. And you, most comics, they sit in the green room. I go, nah, yo, I look at this like prison. I want to look in the prison yard and see who the baddest nigga is, because I'm going to shank you first to make an example. I see the drunk bitch sitting in the third row. I see the nigga with the weird hat or the crazy outfit. I'm sizing up the crowd so that I already know if this situation presents itself, I got to take you out first. Bitch, I got you with that hat. Look at this motherfucker right here. And I want the crowd to see me do it for that exact same reason you just said.
Absolutely.
Oh, this nigga, he casing the joint. Absolutely. I got to know my exit routes. I got to know where the cameras is. So, yeah, man.
So do you always read the room before you say any jokes?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yep. I'm going to get you before you get me.
Logic. I want you to get in here. How much preparation, you know, does it take, you know, for somebody to try to get to an Aries level? Because you've been there. You understand the business and the grind from even, I believe you even signed a contract with Disney at an early age, correct? Doing some acting.
This guy did his homework.
Oh yeah. I make sure I do that. But explain for the people down here on Earth, you know, what it takes to to hone a craft like that. Because when we're listening to Mr. Spears, you're either born with it or you're not. But some of us without those, you know, Avengers super serums, you know, have to understand what it takes to be consistent. I think that's the most important part about business, you know, and ideas and dreams and wants is understanding consistency. And understanding consistency is a craft within itself. Sure. Explain to us what it takes to run the Gria Party, to be an assistant principal, to get up there in front of a crowd consistently, get heckled and want to come back.
What Aries said, man, you know, I'm gonna speak for my thing. I think I was born, you know, funny and to be an intellectual and a scholar and whatnot, and a teacher. However, I'll speak for myself, man, it's something I gotta work at, because you don't necessarily know what you're born with until a certain time in your life. I mean, you know what I'm saying? So, you know, being funny and being a comedian is two different, fundamentally, categorically different things. You can be funny all day long, but if you don't know certain techniques, see, maybe Aries don't got to practice. I got to practice. I got to practice my callbacks.
I ain't on no Allen Iverson shit. Practice. No, nigga, I practice.
Okay. I just wanted that point of clarification. That's why. I mean, because you got to have your callbacks right. You got to know when to do your blue humor at certain parts. And sometimes, you know, me as an educator and as a teacher, I can do very little, if not any explicit, you know what I'm saying, material, because I know stuff can hit HR real quick. So, you know, I take pride in the PG, the PG-13, you know what I'm saying, jokes that I do, and the puns, and just a slick way of doing social commentary and whatnot. But I will say that what Aries does as a living, without a doubt, and I'll debate anyone, it's the hardest art medium to do.
You know, I'm sorry, but you just said it when you went, just funny and being a comedian is two different things. It's like in terms of a sports analogy, it's like motherfuckers that play and one pickup ball versus the pros. Like, you know, you can be hot sauce all day and that shit look good. Like I tell people, being funny in front of your friends and your family is the safest place you can be in, because they're already emotionally invested in you. They already like you. You're already comfortable. Now, getting on stage in front of a crowd that don't know you, and you looking in the face of a dude that's on his first date with a chick, and he realizes he ain't getting no pussy just because he bought hot wings and wine. Now, this nigga got an attitude looking at you like, nigga, make me laugh. This bitch ain't gonna fuck me, so I'm mad at you. That's a different challenge.
Segueing into that,
y'all can't just keep doing this show and not laugh.
Let me say something real quick, because I really want to pinpoint on this and on this intersection between comedy, you know what I'm saying, and teaching. I think that what, you know, I know in my heart what he does is the hardest thing to do at the professional level, to make someone laugh. I mean, it's just like, it's very hard. But on the flip end, on the professional level, teaching is one of the hardest to do too, because you're having people standing there. It's like, okay, teach me. Especially if they're coming into the room with a whole different mindset than, you know, what they're trying to learn. So you're doing the same thing with comedy. I'm gonna make you laugh at something that I know you don't think is funny. I'm gonna make you learn something as a teacher that you don't even agree with.
Not only that, most people probably think they know better than you. They're smarter than you, especially the youth. They think they know everything.
Yeah.
So, yeah. You know, at least with comedy, yeah, you might have a couple people that go, man, I'm funnier than him. I could do that. But the majority of the audience doesn't believe they're funnier than you.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Segue into that with the, you know, like you said, it's a true ability to be able to teach and be funny. It's a mutant ability to be able to do both. My wife and I.
And I am an X-Men.
You are. My wife and I recently, about 3 weeks ago, binged watched A Different World. I want to ask you, Mr. Spears, about that environment and the ability to learn, and how much you learned from your period in time with A Different World. Describe that set. I mean, we're talking about legends like Jasmine Guy, Kadeem Harvin, Hardison, Don Lewis, Cree Summer. Cree Summer went on to voice almost every single cartoon that we can think of, from A Different World all the way up until now. You know, she's everywhere. Describe some of those interactions and those experiences while working on that set.
You know, it's so surreal, man, because before you get into this game, you visualized in your mind scenarios. But then there are certain scenarios that happen that you didn't see coming. Like it's weird, because
I grew up watching Different World. Right after The Cosby Show went off, boom, Different World. I never thought I would find myself on set next to Kadeem and Jasmine. So, you know, it's a surreal feeling that you don't know what to make of it, because you're just like, I grew up watching these people. Now they are knowing me, working with me, and it's hard to take in. I think at the time, I was such a kid in a candy store with my jaw on the floor, it didn't register. But now that I look back at it and I just go, wow. Like, and this is where when people that know my history and know how long I've been doing this, they'll say, because of that, yo, dog, you're a legend. Again, I'm not owning up to that. But when I look back and go, I'm 31 years in this. Oh, yeah, I did that. You know, when I recently posted the skit where DMX was on Mad TV and I played his mother. And we both, yeah, dog, we sounded like that. And everybody was like, yo, that's legendary, that this legendary comedian, this well-respected hood, hood rapper, did a skit with you doing him. Most people would love to be able to say they met DMX. I work with the motherfucker. So it's just, I'm not a legend, but I've done some legendary shit.
Iconic.
Dre, can I ask Aria a question?
Go ahead.
Aries, brother, Aries.
It's Aries, I thought I said Aries, my bad.
No, sir. You're saying Ari, it's all good.
If in the beginning you said something that you kind of, you alluded to, but you stopped. So I want to press you a little bit because I think our audience can appreciate where you may open up. You were talking about the legendary tag that's thrown, and you talked about how, you know, about Kevin and McDonald's, you know,
right.
You kind of gave that, you know, framework. And you said, and you explained, you ended it with, but that's where maybe that's why I'm in the place that I am now. I'm at now. What does that mean?
You know, I did a skit on Mad TV called No Blacks on the TV Screen. And it was a spoof of Chris Rock's No Sex in the Champagne Room with Gerald LaVert. And we were basically, the whole skit was the premise of how Black people just don't get the same opportunities on television that white people get. So this was around the time Chris Rock had his show on HBO, The Chris Rock Show. And I remember I had dinner with him one night, and this, I'm dating myself now. I had a copy of the episode on a VHS tape. So I handed him the VHS tape and said, hey, Chris, man, can you look at this? If you think it's funny, maybe we could work together, do something. So he took it. He said, all right, brother, I'm not going to make no promises, but I'll give you three pieces of advice. Keep writing, keep being funny, and most importantly, try not to piss these white folks off. So it's like, I've done a lot of things, said a lot of things, posted a lot of things, done a lot of interviews where I have spoken very freely and honestly and candidly about how I feel about race in this business and race and in life. And it comes with a price tag. I've made some mistakes in some of the things I've said. But even the things that I said that I don't regret, would I take it back for a different outcome? I want to say yes, because I want that different outcome. But I'm also feeling like I'm lying to myself, because nothing makes me feel worse than not being who I really am. I don't sleep well at night feeling like I tap dance my way into something instead of walking into it with dignity and the way that I want to walk into it.
Can I ask you a question based on that right there?
Yeah.
Because you're educating people right now. Dre had mentioned earlier that once you start talking about your life in the business and elements of it, that's when other people are thinking, well, I'm not a comedian, I'm not in show business, but in my life, I may be tap dancing, or in my life, right? I may be dancing around an issue and not being my whole self. When you said that you were really at this stage of your life, kind of focused in on the money, right? Kind of like fame, if it comes, it's all good, right? But right now it's all about paper. You 75 and I'm 76. So we probably both class of 94, right? In that same area. We cut from the same, we in the same cloth, right? It's all about the bread. Do you think people with real bread tap dance to get it that look like me and you?
Well, like, when you say people with real bread, now we have to get specific. White folks don't tap dance because they write the music.
I'm talking about Black folks that look like us, like Jay and Puffy and LeBron, like people, Jordan, people, Oprah, like, or even the people we don't even name.
Okay. Maybe they don't tap dance, but do you see the common thread with all those people you named?
Yeah, make da-da-da-da-da.
They're safe. They don't make noise. They don't bite the hand that feeds them. They stay in their lane. Hollywood likes niggas happy. Jazz hands. Not this. This.
You think?
And I do a lot of this. So, you know, like I said, I keep saying, it comes with a price. Paul Mooney's a fucking legend. Paul Mooney's a bad motherfucker. You're a bad motherfucker when you write for other bad motherfuckers. But Paul Mooney ain't never got the credit he deserves because he's this.
Absolutely.
My first comedy special for Showtime was called Hollywood Look, I'm Smiling. The cover is of me in blackface with three white executives looking over me, and the title, Hollywood Look, I'm Smiling, because they all would automatically assume if you're not cheesing and you're not doing this, you're the angry Black man. So I was being sarcastic within the title of I'm Smiling. I'm the ultimate nigga. I'm a nigga in blackface. What could be more approving than that?
And I think that's dope. And I think that's one of the reasons why people aren't able to draw that distinction between comedy and teaching, is because a lot of times what we do as comedians, we don't provide some kind of social commentary to it. There are some rare cases with the Chris Rock and, of course, Dave Chappelle. And I think that's the reason why Dave Chappelle is taking it to a next level, is because with his comedy, he's actually providing social commentary, a serious aspect where he's actually explaining it through, you know, social commentary. So I think that is the next step for Black comedians, is to bridge that gap and show that alignment between comedy and teaching and how they play off each other, and they're really married to each other.
Also, Aries, one last question before we, if we have to like go, is, do you show up every day, your whole authentic self, to your work, to what you're doing, to the stage? Do you fully transparently show up as yourself in these stages? And without dancing, without all this Hollywood lights and stuff, fully with humility, because, you know, with success, there's always humility and humbleness, but fully when we're talking about the realness. And, you know, there's obviously, there's the mask, there's no mask when you're on stage. How do you show up? Are you full, like, yourself, your whole authentic?
Yeah, I am, because I have such a respect for the honesty of it. Yeah. You know, Patrice, again, another guy who, and it was interesting because before his passing, people felt like he was on his way, but we don't ever really know because he passed. But he was another guy who some might even say was self-destructive, because he believed in truth. And he once told Dane Cook, the truth, you always win with the truth. Never underestimate truth. So I take pride in being honest. And I think there's such a nobility and a respect factor in people who are truthful. No matter how ugly, how painful, I just like the truth. You know what I mean? And when you bring up Dave, let's be honest. Dave is the best and the number one guy at being able to bridge that gap between truth and funny. it's not an easy thing to do. Yeah. And there are a lot of comics who try and do it, and they Dave is a monster at that truth. You know, when I watch his special, Equanimity, and he does the thing at the end where he talks about Emmett Till, if you really pay attention, you could hear a mouse piss on cotton. He's got the audience in his hand. They are not just listening. They are leaning forward. The way he breaks that down, the way he uses silence, timing, I always say, Dave, if comedy was music, Dave is Thelonious Monk. He's Miles Davis. That nigga is jazz. It just flows. And it's beautiful. It's beautiful to watch.
And it's interesting because you said that he has such a close relationship with so many hip hop artists. And I feel like he admires them just as much as, you know, they admire him.
Absolutely.
How he hangs out with Talib Kweli and Dead Prez, and he really marriages so many Black cultural art mediums, and he teaches through that. And when Dre was talking about the Griot Party experience, something that started, I think it's really interesting. I feel like the ancestors are speaking to us right now, because there's no coincidence that when he received that Mark Twain Award, he talked about him being a griot or a jolly. That's the original word. He talked about being a griot, and a griot is that. A griot is a cultural custodian. It's a poet. It's a comedian. It's a teacher. It's a warrior with words, that the community don't do nothing unless the griot, you know, has spoken. And he intertwines so many. He uses the same time that we use in hip hop with the punchlines and deliveries and the silence and the timing and the cadence. He does that too. And so when we look at Black people as artists, we got to learn how to harness and galvanize all of our talents as artists and as creatives. Because when you say you're a creative person, you're basically saying you are a creator. And there's no coincidence that that word sounds like the creator. And that is Black people. We are the creator of, you know, mankind, humankind, wherever you want to say it, of this species on earth. And that's what the Griot Party experience is about. I got musicians, a band, I got hip hop artists, I got spoken word artists, I got singers, I got tap dancers. We're all galvanizing that to create institutions that create safe places for us to have financial autonomy, and for us to create as liberal artists and bring back the revolution, kind of similar to like the Harlem Renaissance.
Right.
Absolutely.
You know, Dave had one of my, again, one of my favorite jokes. And I think this one was on the one special when he first came out on Netflix. But he did that joke where he talked about a white woman standing up in his audience and go, women suffer. Yes, you do. Women suffer. Yes, you do. Women suffer just like you. Slow your roll, bitch. And then he explains in the joke how basically he said white women, just like white men, when it came to racism and doing niggas dirty, y'all was in on the heist. You just didn't like your cut. And I mean, again, I think I have moments of that kind of genius. But Dave's consistency, I mean, this nigga put out 5 specials in what, a year? It take me 5 years to put out one. So this motherfucker is just, his mind is another level, man. And like I said, if everybody could be Dave, we all would be Dave, because he's that dope.
But I would say, yeah, I agree with that. And add on to that, you're a better comedian, you're a better writer the more you read. And the more experiences that you put in writing, you know what I'm saying? And I can tell that Dave reads a lot, you know what I'm saying? And I can tell that how my artistry changes when I read. And I think I'm a better comedian, I'm a better hip hop artist, I'm a better producer based on my ability to teach, but also learn. But also the more you read, the better you write, and the more you write, the better you read. And that all goes hand in hand. And you know, I just put it out there to any comedian. you know what I'm saying? Or anyone who's doing anything in these artistic spaces, read, learn, and write down your experiences. And I guarantee you, you'll see that your craft is going to get better.
And the in the in what as a as an entrepreneur, like a full-fledged, will probably like lose a skin off my back entrepreneur, I'll say to add to that logic, learn how to, two things I would add. A, learn how to count money, right? Honestly, learn how to count your own money. Know where it goes, know how to keep it safe, and know how to grow it when you're not using it. I learned that aspect, and I did. And the second thing is to identify somebody that you can mentor, that can mentor you. Like identify a person that had that is doing what you're trying to do in some capacity, right? So you can learn from their mistakes, you can harbor their strengths, and you could take parts of that individual and put it in your own toolbox. Because a lot of times we try to recreate the wheel, and you know, listening to everybody talk today, you've all referenced people who have come 20, 30, 40 years before, right? Doing some portions of a craft. And if you could take bits and pieces from those individuals, it'll save you heartache and probably some type of financial loss if you do that.
Well, then let's make sure you and I exchange numbers.
Absolutely.
I thought that was a given.
Hey, I love y'all. I got to get ready to split, y'all.
I appreciate your time. Thank you for it.
Thank you,
Aries.
And before I go, please check out my podcast, Spears and Steinberg, a.k.a. The Jew and the Jerk, available on all streaming platforms. Or hit me up in my Instagram.
Right now.
There you go, brother. Oh, I know I'm going to be called all kinds of coons and sambos because of this latest episode today, based on my opinion on the Mikayla Bryant situation. But I just say to anybody that wants to check out my podcast, start from episode one, try to binge listen and go in order. It matters comedically, so you can track the growth and the evolution of the show and get a lot of the callback jokes. Or hit me up in my Instagram under Aries Spears, blue check mark, slide in my DMs, and I'll send you the links.
Appreciate I'd love you. To bring you on to our label, so let's talk.
I'll put the bat signal in the air. I'll meet you on the roof like Commissioner Gordon.
Da, 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 da.
There you go.
And with that being said, Technical Talks out here making connections that matter. We want to thank everybody for joining us today and a little bit of comedic therapy, understanding the game from a business perspective, from a Black perspective, from a holistic perspective. I want to thank Rubelin. I want to thank Logic. I want to thank Dr. Davis for being here. And I especially want to thank the icon. We won't call him a legend. We'll call him an icon. Call him the icon, Aries Spears, for teaching us today. Thank you.
All love.
Peace.
Peace.
All right.